Hello, I'm Jane Crowell, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by two of our contributors. I've got Leila Latif, hello.
Hi.
And Masana Ahmed.
Hello.
Hello, both of you. We're going to be talking lots of things today. We are talking Oscars, but we're also reviewing Michael B. Jordan's Without Remorse, Irish rom-com Wild Mountain Time, coming-of-age drama Beast Beast, and Netflix family movie The Mitchells vs. The Machines. But before we get started on those, we probably should talk about the biggest event that's happened in cinema for this week, the Oscars. How did you guys find it? I mean, it's the last one, it's the biggie. Did they learn any lessons from previous award ceremonies, or was it just not even working still? Masana, you stayed up.
Yeah, I'll just begin by saying that the results were more or less predictable, except for the best actor, because of the way they had repositioned that, putting it yes. after best film. So it felt like it was leading to this grand moment of remembering Chadwick Boseman, and that didn't happen. And then ultimately, it felt like everyone was slighted. The audience, Chadwick Boseman's family, Anthony Hopkins. It was kind of a mess at the end there. To start with, it was pretty good. I liked the setup. It looked more visually appealing to me in the Union Station with the sunshine leaking in and this more cinematic aspect ratio. And I also liked the storytelling element they added to their nominees. For example, when Bong Joon-ho read out the Best Director nominees, he shared their responses to this question. In 20 seconds, how would you describe directing? And when Brad Pitt read out Supporting Actress, he was talking about how the nominees were inspired by the acting they saw in films when they were young. And I thought those were interesting. They're sort of almost like mini profiles in a way. However, I think what's more important is to actually show the clips of them acting in those films, because the average viewer may not have seen all of those films and therefore has no reference point to just how good these nominees are. And it really felt like a weird mix of trying to target a mass audience, but also just trying to target cinephiles who, by assuming that they've already seen these films, they already know how good Olivia Colman was in The Father, for example. But really, there's nothing to show how effective her performance was.
Yeah, we didn't see very much film actually at all. We had no montages, no sort of stirring orchestral music over great moments in cinema. We didn't have anything to really celebrate film. What did you think, Leila?
I have to say, I didn't massively miss the clips when it came to the acting categories, because they tend to go with just like these really like
random
melodramatic moments. And it's just kind of like, you know, five women crying in a row. But I really missed it when they were kind of getting into like sound and the editing and cinematography awards, because I was like, oh, you could actually just show us how beautiful the cinematography in Nomadland is, or a moment of the sound design of Sound of Metal. And I think it was a shame to just kind of be told about those things.
Absolutely. And what about the upset at the end? Was that a silly gamble by Soderbergh and the rest of the producers to hinge it on Chadwick Boseman winning and then deny old Anthony Hopkins the chance to actually accept his award?
Yeah, I think it was really cruel.
100%.
Just the fact that it's come out now that Anthony Hopkins requested, like, could he please zoom in because there's a pandemic and he's 83, and they said no, you go to the satellite thing at 5 a.m in London or nothing. And like, that just seems really unnecessarily mean of a way to treat someone, and especially if you've seen The Father, which is all about empathy for older people. I mean, I think he's amazing, and I think it's his best performance ever. And you know, it was sad to not have that moment for Chadwick Boseman's widow in particular, but you cannot deny that Anthony Hopkins earned that award.
I would also say that it was disrespectful to the best film in a way, because this was an opportunity for the Oscars to really champion something. And Nomadland is a pretty interesting one because it's like heavy on improvisation. There's this real focus on naturalism. It's something that's not usually promoted in the mainstream. To have a film like Nomadland win the best film, and it's not this talking point of the night, it's not the thing that people are going to take away from the show. You know, I have to wonder how that undercuts the legacy of this great film.
Yeah, because it's obviously a film that won Best Director for the first woman of colour. I mean, that's a major achievement. It's also Best Actress in a film that is led by women. I mean, women are the focal point of this film. It felt a bit weird to have like, oh yes, so that woman film, we've done with that. And now let's have this guy award because that's the most important thing of the night. It really felt disjointed and odd.
Yeah, we've had quite a few bad Best Picture wins over the past few years. I mean, there was kind of this being so anticlimactic, and then, you know, them turning the lights off basically on the Parasite crowd, and then poor Barry Jenkins, that mix up. So it's like, I don't understand how they can't get that right. They have all year to think about it, and yet it seems to so often be just a bit off.
Yeah. And Musana, you were saying you wanted to see more stuff celebrating films that are coming up as well, especially this year when, you know, we've had so little and we haven't had any big screen outings. You wanted to see more of the films that we can expect to.
One of the most exciting parts of the show for me was seeing the trailers of Nine Perfect Strangers, the upcoming all-star TV show, and the trailer for Steven Spielberg's West Side Story, which looks quite, you know, glorious. And I think that the Oscars should take away lessons from the Super Bowl and the Game Awards, where the focus is on making people tune in to see the reveal or something new about the things that they are excited for. It's crazy to me that the movie awards are the ones with the least amount of previews and trailers.
Yeah.
And looking at the ratings, seeing it crash down to below 10 million viewers across the US for the first time ever, I think you can renew the appetite by saying, stay tuned to the Oscars to see upcoming trailers for all your favorite films or, you know, first time reveals. Yeah, I really think that that's the way to inject some life into it by promoting upcoming cinema.
What do you think, Leila? How would they inject some life into it for you?
I just kind of feel that during these kind of pandemic conditions, it doesn't lend itself well to like that glory. But yeah, I think that would have been really fun. I mean, I'm with you. That West Side Story trailer was the most excited I got.
And the most cinematic thing that they actually produced of the whole show. Apart from, obviously, we've got to give praise to Regina King and her strut through the station at the beginning of the show. I mean, great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It went downhill from there, sadly, but it was a great moment.
Yeah, and it did seem like something from a film and like, yeah, that kind of beautiful glamour that Steven Soderbergh can bring to everything. And like, it really was like then just a balloon being deflated. And when halfway through, I was like, you know what? I think at least in the room, they're having a nice time.
Yeah, I love that they put Carey Mulligan up on a shelf like a proper dolly in that gold dress, and you could always just see her sitting at one side, and on the other side, Amanda Seyfried in her sort of red dress and the two dollies. I mean, we had Glenn Close's debut shuffle, which at the time felt scripted and awkward, and now we learn was scripted and fed to her. Just sort of, why did they leave that so late as well? Like with 50 minutes of the ceremony to go, they just suddenly decide, let's get her doing some twerking. There was none of that fun, was there?
No. And I do wonder whether what they need is a host again, like someone really great who can just kind of keep the energy up. Like if it had been Regina, that would have been great. If they just kept bringing back Regina, it would have been wonderful.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, well, let's hope next year that it gets better, because of course we're still going to watch it, aren't we? We are suckers for this. So shall we see what we might be looking at in next year's Oscars? Might it be this? Are we ready for some Tom Clancy delivered by Michael B. Jordan?
There's something inside of me that I can't turn off. A part of me that won't stop for anything. No remorse.
So, Musana, who's without remorse?
So John Kelly is without remorse. John Kelly is a Navy SEAL played by Michael B. Jordan, who we first meet in the middle of a mission in Syria to rescue a CIA operative who is taken hostage by former Spetsnaz officers. And then following that rescue mission, his home is invaded by Russian hitmen in retaliation, who execute his pregnant wife and leave him for dead. And then the film then follows John on a fairly simple vigilante mission to find the assassins, but a key piece of information about one of them is then unveiled as a huge matter of interest to the CIA, who then get involved as part of this bigger story with John Kelly. One that centers on clandestine operations, personal revenge, and even tensions between America and Russia. I really enjoyed this film, and I knew I would when I saw it was the reteaming of director Stefano Sollima and the writer Taylor Sheridan. Both of them previously worked together on Sicario 2, which I thought was mostly good, but then the third act went off the rails. However, I saw that it was a collaboration that worked. They complemented each other's style, and I'm happy to say I didn't have those sort of narrative issues with Without Remorse. And in fact, I was actually quite impressed because I know the source material.
Yeah, you're a Kansas fan, are you?
Yes, very much. Jingoism included, I can, you know, I can overlook some things. I've engaged with a lot of Tom Clancy's work, including the original story this film is based on. And I thought that they did a good job at both toning down the inherent rah-rah jingoism of the author's work and also by really focusing on this vengeful protagonist through this very personal lens. You just know that he can't trust anyone, whether the Russian militia or American officials. And it's also a good adaptation because it trims the excess of the novel, which has this whole strand revolved around a pimp and drug running. And Sheridan and Sollima have made it cleaner, sleeker, tighter. And I think that value of efficiency is also conveyed in the aesthetic, because the action sequences are so matter-of-fact, it's almost elegant how raw the violence is. And maybe that's the wrong response to such brutal scenarios, but that was also an effect of both Sicario films. And ultimately, I would say if you like Sicario, you will like this one. If you don't care about Sicario, I would at least recommend it just for Michael B. Jordan, who I think is so compelling as John Kelly. He brings the brawn, the fury, and the pathos that the character needs. There's this wordless scene where he revisits the home after it's been violated, and I hope they didn't make him do too many takes of that because he really puts everything into that moment of catharsis.
Mm. Did you like it, Layla?
Yeah, I did like it. I don't think I liked it quite as much. But yeah, I think Michael B. Jordan is absolutely wonderful in it. And he like really just kind of embodies this man who just has nothing left to lose. And you completely believe this sort of like fire of vengeance in him. What I really love is something that I didn't realize that I was missing, which was that the pain and the brutality of all the violence felt so real to me. And as much as I love my Marvel films, like there's a certain sense in a lot of the fight scenes that you get at the end of WandaVision or The Falcon of Fury, like you don't really get that like this hurts, like the actual like feeling of agony that these people are subjecting their bodies to. And in this one, it was like really like visceral, actually the emotional agony that he's in, but also like the violence of it like felt really real. It really drew me in. The thing I would say, though, is I think it was just a little overstuffed for me. Like, we just kind of are like burning through things so quickly that I would have liked a few more moments where we just kind of pause and like establish what's going on a little bit more. When I saw the cast list, there's like a character actor in this that I really love, and I was excited to see him. And then he comes and it's like 30 seconds gone. It's like, okay, that's just the pace of this. And I would have liked it to slow down a little more
breathing space, maybe.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for Bond, obviously, as we all have, No Time to Die. And this felt like a really good sort of, you know, salve for waiting for that. Michael B. Jordan is every bit as brutal as sort of Daniel Craig was in sort of Casino Royale when he first burst in and was really physical and visceral. And then, you know, you've got this great female character as well in Jodie Smith. I just thought she was really great. I loved her. She's got this quite calm, girlish almost voice, and yet she commands such power with it, and she's his sort of boss, and she is very, very authoritarian without being a shouty girl, which is what, you know, generally we see when we see women portraying commanders. I really love that dynamic between the two of them as well. They'd sort of stolen a little bit of Bond's thunder here.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Certainly the cast is a big part of it. Those scenes between Michael B. Jordan and Jodie Turner-Smith are wonderful. I appreciated the ethical ambiguity of Jamie Bell's character.
Yep.
And I thought Guy Pearce, you know, he did his thing. I should really mention that there is a mid-credit scene in this film, and you'll especially enjoy it if you know of Tom Clancy's source material. I won't spoil what happens, but it will be a treat for those who know Tom Clancy and like Tom Clancy.
I mean, obviously, Tom Clancy, this moves on to Rainbow Six, doesn't it? So do you think they've done enough here to pique interest for that film? And would you like to see an adaptation of that?
I certainly would want to see more John Kelly played by Michael B. Jordan, regardless of the story, whether it's a Rainbow Six or not. I don't know if necessarily they've set it up cohesively to say that this is how Rainbow Six will begin, but it's there. It's possible. I can see the transition for sure. I think they have a really good foundation here for more Tom Clancy adaptations.
Yeah. Do you think that John Kelly by Michael B. Jordan will run and run Layla? Do you think this is something that could be his next franchise?
I hope so. I mean, he's got such kind of innate charisma. It almost seems unfair to be that good looking and that talented at the same time. I really want to see a lot more of him in particular in this character, because it's like a much kind of harder edge than we're used to seeing from him. I mean, even though like Killmonger is like a murderer, this is a much more kind of brutal side to Michael B. Jordan. I really am very excited to see hopefully more of this. I've never read a Tom Clancy novel, but I think I might have to start.
Oh, with him in mind, yeah. As you read. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I should mention that I don't think they did it in this film, but in the original novel, one of the characters is Jack Ryan's father, Emmett Ryan. And Jack Ryan is a character who's we are very well acquainted with in cinema, from Harrison Ford through to Chris Pine. So then that could be a potential crossover idea. I don't know if they would recast Chris Pine or bring in John Krasinski from the television adaptation of Jack Ryan, but there's a lot of potential for some cool team-ups and crossovers.
Okay, the wider universe. Okay, so if you fancy a little bit of Without Remorse, it's available on Amazon Prime from tomorrow. Okay, so before we go on to our next movie, it's time for our regular, a little something we call plain talking. And this week's movie jargon, to be explained, is a hard out. What's a hard out, Layla?
Is that when they just kind of brutally end the interview?
It's generally when you're told that you can only have a certain amount of time with somebody because they have a hard out. It's regimented. They are leaving the building. And yes, they will just cut your interview brutally, as you say, to get that person out of the door.
Oh, I have had this happen to me several times. I'm like, most of my interviews have happened over Zoom, and it always seems to be that just like a little voice pops up and they will say that like they have something else to do. That actually happened with me for a interview that I did for the current issue of Total Film. Very kindly, the wonderful director, Barry Jenkins, stopped this hard out and did say to me, like, no, she deserves 10 more minutes. It can wait. So,
we love that. So, yeah. Barry Jenkins isn't into a hard out. Have you ever been the victim of a hard out, Masana? Or do you do a hard out? Are you like, dudes, I'm out. I'm gone. Speak to my people after 8 p.m.
I have worked the red carpet at times, and that's probably the tangible example of a hard out. The talent is literally dragged away from you. And you are told, bye, sorry, sorry, sorry. And, you know, you lose those precious minutes. You might even get an awkward moment off camera of trying to ask them a question at the same time.
Following them with a mic.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, I'm very glad that there is a term to this unpleasant thing that has happened to me so many times. Like, now I can talk about it rather than feel a little bit sad by myself.
It's basically that, not that we've ever experienced this ourselves, apart from your Barry Jenkins, but generally that talent do not have that extra 10 minutes to play with, and they have to be out of the junket and gone by a specific time, whether that's awkward or not. And so they are literally dragging people away or up the red carpet. But I think we should, you know, adopt it in our own lives. Go out with your mates and say, I've got a hard out at X o'clock. And just abruptly leave. I suppose it's like a French exit. Just disappear. You've had your hard out.
I'm a big fan of an Irish farewell where you just pretend that you're going to the bathroom and leave.
And just disappear.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So that is a hard out. Let's move on to our next movie. This time, it's a film that caused uproar on social media when it was released in the US at Christmas. It's this.
Anthony. Never marry.
If it comes to that, I'll freeze my eggs.
You should freeze your whole body if you're waiting for that one.
Will you call us equal?
We ever had a dream since you were a child, and you couldn't let it go.
So you put this gate between us.
Has your dream made you happy or miserable?
You kissed him!
It was he that kissed me!
That's what's got him worked up!
I don't understand you people. Why do you make everything so hard? Just seem to accept these crazy things.
I don't like a fight.
Well, who does?
Half of Ireland, just not me.
If my true love, he were gone, I wish...
So all those lilting Irish pipes and Irish accents, this is Wild Mountain Time. Layla, set this up for us?
Sure. So this is from writer-director John Patrick Shanley, who is the person who was behind Moonstruck, one of the most wonderful romantic comedies ever made, and recently won a Pulitzer for Doubt, that Meryl Streep and Viola Davis, incredible drama about child abuse, which I need to set up because it makes what comes next all the more surprising. This is a sort of slightly surreal romantic comedy, I guess, set in a little village in Ireland where there's two neighboring farms, and one of them has Jamie Dornan's family and the other one has Emily Blunt's family. They're sort of childhood friends but never really got together, and then there's some, you know, for reasons which become apparent in the final act. It's really weird, this film. And I love a So Bad It's Good film. And this isn't that, because it's also really boring as being like absolutely mad at times. And the accents are terrible. The wigs are terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, I would have put Emily Blunt as being the sort of person that can elevate anything. Even she cannot make this a decent film.
And it's
not
astonishing when Jamie Dornan actually is Irish and still sounds weirdly unconvincingly Irish in it. I don't understand. Like, everything about it is inauthentic. Mosana, what about it did you like the most, if anything?
Nothing. You know, if I saw this film at a cinema, I would have given it an Irish farewell. You know, it just really doesn't give you much to talk about until its big twist. Before that, it's plainly boring, just like Layla said. And then after that, it's just completely absurd. It's very below average period romance fare for the most part. Just like Layla said, I wouldn't even say it's worthy of the So Bad It's Good label, because it's only really applicable to the last third, which is, you know, kind of too little, too late. But I think why that twist is something people are talking about is because the film is just so sincere, and the film's commitment to sincerity is how it can wield its power as something that's so, so bad it's good. And in this one, you watch as Jamie Dornan and Emily Blunt perform this farce with so much force, as if it's a Tennessee Williams play.
No.
And I think that's what makes it so laughable. Yeah, it's a howler. I wish they had done that big reveal earlier on, because it is really boring until that point, and I'm not even sure if most people are going to see the ending of this film due to that.
And we should mention Christopher Walken's in it, doing an Irish accent.
Oh.
John Hamm turns up as a sort of New York guy. There's lots of like pipey Irishy music and soaring visions of green fields, and the music is by Jamie Dornan's wife, Amelia Warner. It's like you would have a setup at the beginning of a film to take the piss out of this film, sort of like, this is an Irish film, but it's not that film. And it opens with Christopher Walken saying, "Welcome to Ireland." And you're like, when's the other shoe going to drop? And it never does. This is the island that they're welcoming us to, where it rains and people shoot crows and sort of are just random and weird. And this twist obviously won't spoil the twist, but did you think that the twist was as actual as people have been talking about? I mean, a character reveals that they feel a certain way. Do we think that they are talking metaphysically and people have latched onto this as a real thing? I mean, if it's really what they are saying, it's absolutely bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah, I knew about the twist before when I came in. About 40 people on Twitter had spoiled it for me.
Right.
And I would say, knowing the twist, watching in particular the first act, it's completely literal. Like, that is something that he is playing right from minute one, if you know that it's coming. But it's just, you don't get it, because why on earth would that be the case? The writer-director isn't Irish, and I think that is why you end up with this like really like shallow, cliched version of Ireland. Watching this actually did make me appreciate how difficult tonal shifts are, like something like Promising Young Woman or any of the like Coen brothers films, when they can go from something quite sweet and lovely into something quite dark. And I mean, there's lines in this where like Emily Blunt says, "Oh, I think of nothing else but killing myself," or something along those lines. So like, there are darkness and then like levity. That's hard to do, I guess, because this does it so badly.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I mean, the dog's probably the best actor in it, isn't he?
Yeah. You know, I remember last year when people were making fun of Pixie, they were saying that's distilling every stereotype of Ireland into one film, and it has really bad accents, highlighting Alec Baldwin. But Pixie is brilliant compared to this film.
A triumph.
It's incomparable.
Jamie Dornan, all that goodwill he'd got from me with Barb and Star, but he's singing in this again, but not in a good way.
No. I mean, I actually think Barb and Star is the only time Jamie Dornan has been good, in my opinion. I didn't like the 50 Shades of Grey film. And I think that was also like an issue that it had, because you have this like, you know, charisma vacuum of a man in this film. And then you have like wonderful John Hamm come in, and like, it's supposed to be
a
like
love triangle,
a contest between these two guys, like this one that's wonderful and wealthy and handsome and kind to you and wants to whisk you off to New York. And then this weird dude, like, it just didn't make any sense.
I know. And then there's horses banging down stables. There's just a lot of rain. There's a gate. It's a mess, isn't it?
I'm not sure who this film is for.
But if you are intrigued to know what the twist is and to see people do Irish accents, which apparently the director said that if he'd done real Irish accents, no one could understand them. So he's had to soften them into this sort of generic Irish accent, which I find astonishing considering there are lots of films set in Ireland with authentic Irish accents. Calm with Horses had authentic Irish accents and no one had a problem understanding that. So if you enjoy a Hollywood Irish accent, and Christopher Walken doing that halting cadence with an Irish accent, and all other weirdness, this might be for you. And it is available on demand from tomorrow. And we wish you the best of luck with that. Before we get on to the next film, it's time to test your film nerd powers with alternative line reading. Do you know what this is, guys?
I do. Yeah. I listen to this podcast.
So I'm going to do a dreadful accent, which is in keeping with that film. And so I'm going to do something, I think, in the style of Miss Jean Brodie. So here we go. See if you know what film this is from. I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening? Plastics. What film is that from? I apologise to all our Scottish listeners.
Yeah, I already know because I love this film. It's from The Graduate.
It is from The Graduate, and it is the party where he's being told about his future.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I apologise for that. But I'm also...
That was better than anything in Wild Mountain Time.
I'm going to make somebody else do it next week. Okay, it's time for our next review. Let's look at this family film for the bank holiday weekend.
Every family has its challenges. We haven't had a good family picture in years because you two are always arguing. For my family, our greatest challenge... probably the robot apocalypse.
Attention all robots! Every single person on the planet.
So this is Mitchells versus the Machines. So Musana, tell us about the Mitchells and what machines are they up against?
The Mitchells are a family, fairly everyday family, who don't really appreciate each other, but they do like each other. They just haven't really shown enough gratitude towards each other. And I think a big part of it is because they live in this digital age full of technology, and therefore that basically invades their lives. Until one point, it literally invades their lives when a robot uprising happens after an entrepreneur wants to make one line of his products obsolete, and the robot essentially turns on him, and then the robot apocalypse begins. And all of this is animated, and it's brought to you by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who we know as the minds behind the Jump Street films, the Lego Movie films, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatball duology, as well as producing Into the Spider-Verse. I enjoyed this one very much. I think it's safe to say it's another winner from Lord and Miller, although it's directed by Mike Riander, who's making his feature-length debut after working on the TV show Gravity Falls. It always seems like they're trying to do something different with the animated films, right? I think the Cloudy films were fairly normal 3D animation, but then the success of those films, I think, enabled them to experiment a little bit. With the Lego Movie, it was a complete experimentation just in its idea, and it was greater than anybody could have expected. You know, everything was awesome.
love those films.
Spider-Verse was bound to be good considering the source material, but just how awesome and visually inventive it was something that surprised me. And then I guess the hook of this one is that the style of animation mixes 3D and 2D. I think it looks quite wonderful and seamless. I have to imagine it was pretty difficult to pull some of those little effects off without looking too artificial.
Mm.
And I think they've done a terrific job with it. But through all of the interest in pushing the envelope with 3D animation with us, on a studio level especially, they've always kept this firm grasp on building strong characters, an appealing story, and lots of humor. The Mitchells are, you know, very sympathetic family, very relatable in a way. This film is very much about our times, about Wi-Fi, our relationship with technology, and how it affects communication, especially with the people we most care about, because we think that they have our attention anyway, so we can just go on our phones whilst we talk to them. I've read that the director pitched it to executives as Black Mirror for kids, which I think is both very funny and very accurate.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so this film examines that human connection through the odyssey of this one family who want to go on a road trip and, you know, have bonding time with each other, which then transmogrifies into this survival within the robot apocalypse. The effect of this film is that parents and children will feel very grateful for each other after watching this film and have their own moments of bonding. At the very least, I'm sure they'll bond over how they will navigate the inevitable robot uprising that I'm sure will happen in 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, this is from Sony Studio, you know, who they make a lot of these robots. Did you enjoy it, Layla?
Yeah, not quite as much, but I think it was certainly like really funny. And it reminded me a lot of one of my favorite animated films, A Goofy Movie. Like that sort of coming of age element to it. I had quite a few laugh out loud moments, especially with an incident with a mule. but I wasn't 100% sold on the sort of like actual design of it all. Like I found their eyes to be slightly like unsettling and they just seem to be in a constant state of shock. So that kind of like kept me a little bit on edge. And I don't know that all of the amazing actors' voices like fully shone, but I still think it was, it was certainly a very enjoyable 2 hours.
And if you like pugs and you enjoy memes about pugs looking like loaves of bread, there's a very good joke that keeps coming up that I enjoyed immensely. But yeah, who doesn't love a pug with its eyes going in different directions and slobber everywhere?
If Monchi the Pug isn't the internet's favorite thing over the next week, I will be shocked.
Yeah.
This is like prime Baby Yoda lineage, you know?
Yeah, the dog steals it, doesn't he? And then there's Olivia Colman playing the voice of Pal, the evil robot. Did that work? It didn't quite for me.
Yeah, like I just feel like if you've got Olivia Colman, why make her virtually unrecognizable? Even like Maya Rudolph or Eric Andre, like if I didn't have the IMDb, I don't know that I would have known it was them, which is a shame because they are such incredible voices.
I was kind of surprised that some of the humor felt a little bit outdated, like the sort of rage comics from the early 2010s, those sort of faces, you know, the herp derp kind of memes. It seemed to utilize a lot of those. And also, you know, the motif of this film is T.I. featuring Rihanna, Live Your Life, which is a song from around the same time, you know, at least 10 years ago. Yeah, it does feel like something that's been brewing in their heads for about 10 years, and they've kept some of those ideas. I do think in general, though, the humor is not the point of the movie. It is about this family story, and it definitely succeeds in that aspect.
Yeah. It's got a bit of a dad joke vibe, doesn't it? Which is quite charming in a way, isn't it? That it's like a slight naffness.
Yeah, I think charming is the word for it. I felt very warm about it. It wasn't the same feeling I got from the Spider-Verse, which is just like, where you're like, this was so cool. It's not in any way cool, is it? But it does have references to, you know, great horror movies. When they go into the mall, they have a scene in a mall that they reference. There's loads of sort of cultural references for adults and kids. So I think like everybody's going to have a good time watching this, aren't they?
Yeah. And I don't think it's too didactic telling you destroy your phones, turn off your computers and laptops. It doesn't hammer you over the head with that point. I think it's just about simply being able to at least just look up once in a while and realize, you know, how important family is to you.
So why don't everybody watch it with their family and not talk to each other, but watch a screen together? That's essentially what it's inviting you to do.
That's perfect.
Okay, so if you fancy doing that, and then maybe having a lovely conversation with your family after it, The Mitchells versus the Machines is available on Netflix from Friday. Okay, so final movie this week, it's this.
Neato. You go to high school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Panthers.
But that's another episode. Prime Shooter. Leave any questions in the comments.
I'm actually going to be committing more time to my show, the technical side of weapons.
I think it's a nice thing you're doing, Adam.
Thank you, ma'am. Yeah, I think you're right.
Layla, you reviewed Beast Beast for Total Film. Tell us what it's about.
It's kind of quite like a naturalistic indie movie that's about the lives of three different teenagers who kind of vaguely know each other, and they're all living in this small town, and they've all got these kind of similar feelings of like isolation and not really fitting in and like not connecting with their families and with their parents, and it sort of manifests in very different ways for each of them. And in the final act, all these threads collide. I don't want to give it away, but in a tragic fashion. Mm. And that for me is when the film really comes alive. For kind of the first two thirds of it, I was just like, yeah, these people are perfectly charming and all of these performances are strong and this is fine, but what is kind of the point of this? Mm. And sort of when the point of it becomes apparent, I think it's a kind of a heartbreaking, heart-stopping moment and really, really powerful, because the sort of event that it depicts, I think it's quite easy to have a bit of distance from and not compute that this is like real people living their lives that can kind mm-hmm. of have this sort of thing happen to them. So yeah, I really liked Beast Beast.
Yeah. Did you like it, Masana?
Yeah, I did. And I completely agree with Layla. I will say that the film at its core is about, you know, the role of guns in society and the inciting event of the third act, which I won't give away. I wish it happened earlier on, because afterwards it starts exploring all these weighty ideas around guns, such as the immediate response, the role of social media, why people use guns, and you know, the process of healing. And there's all these immediate ideas, which I think we have too little time to digest. So much of before of that is spent on intimately capturing this panorama of youth, which is certainly relatable, but also I think a little bit overly familiar as cinema. It's clearly inspired by filmmakers who have done great work within this realm, including Gus Van Sant, Richard
Linklater,
really
reminded me of
Josephine Decker.
Yeah.
And even Josephine Decker's and Madeline's Madeline, it had a similar visual style and, you know, exploration of the central characters. I'm not entirely sure it's the most refreshing perspective on the subject matter, especially because earlier this year, I attended, well, virtually attended South by Southwest 2021, and I saw Megan Park's The Fallout, which was a big award winner, and that's similar narrative territory, and I think that was a much stronger film. Beast Beast is good, but I'd recommend viewers to make a note of The Fallout when it releases later this year.
I really liked this. I was not expecting a great deal from it, but I really enjoyed the foreboding that's, even though it was this sort of, you know, as you say, very naturalistic, meandering, it's a very quick film as well. It's only an hour and 27 minutes. And for the first hour, it's just sort of meandering through these kids' lives. And as you say, it's very ordinary. But there is, because of the presence of guns in this film, this foreboding where you think this can't continue. And so I found that really weirdly compelling and horrifying. And I liked the fact that it was sort of downplayed their lives. They didn't have extraordinary lives. The girl who is an actress isn't particularly brilliant at acting. One of the guys is a skateboarder who is pretty good. But, you know, they are very ordinary teenagers. Now, it sort of took me back to what you said, Layla, that when certain incidents happen on the news, we can lose sight of the fact that these are entire lives that have been blown apart. These are ordinary kids with ordinary lives and futures ahead of them, and parents who are invested in them and schoolmates who are invested in them, and that can all just be taken away in one incident, which we've seen with the news time and time again. But also, I thought, did you not think it was quite interesting, this sort of coda on the end of the film, which we won't spoil, but that then explored gender and violence against women and the weaponizing of trauma, which I kind of wanted to sit with a little bit longer, like you, Masana. I wanted to sort of explore that a little bit more, because I found that was a really interesting turn of events as well. So all in all, I felt like it was a really interesting film that was, I think Kickstarter had sort of been responsible for getting it together. So for a first effort, I thought really compelling.
Glad you seem to approve of the 4 stars I gave it in.
I do. I agree. I think it's quite an interesting and thought-provoking little thing.
Yeah, it did make me very grateful to not live in America, I must say. As much as it's a wonderful place, and like just that kind of ever presence of guns and like gun culture, you just feel like there's such kind of horrific potential in any moment. Well, I mean, obviously there are some guns around here, but it's not kind of quite the same level. Like just to not live with that kind of tension of the things can in an instant be so horrifying.
And that it explores the idea of intent with a gun and protection versus aggression and all of these things. You know, it's not just guns are bad, is it? It allows you to see that accidents happen, that intent can be completely different to what is reported, etc. So I think it is just quite interesting and would provoke conversation.
I really like the element of the gun obsessed guy using YouTube a lot, because you have this virtual space where people assume his relationship with guns is one thing, whereas in the town that we get to know so closely, we understand it as something else. And that contrast between the online reaction to his videos versus the concern that's within this domestic sphere, I thought that was really fascinating and something that, like you have both said, you can easily lose sight of because it feels so far away. For people on YouTube, to them, it's just another video, right?
Yeah.
But I believe it's the director's brother in that role. And I was thinking that if my sibling wrote a film and that was the part they put for me, I would be very offended.
I was just like, the trousers are so right for this character. He has the perfect khaki trousers. Yeah, I really just believed all of them. Beast is available on demand from tomorrow. I think that might actually be my film of the week. What about you guys? I mean, Masana, I see you're wearing a jumper there that sort of says 90 minutes, I'll never get back, which I think might apply to one of the films this week.
Absolutely. But yeah, my film of the week, though, 100% has to be Without Remorse. I am a big fan of this film.
And the 90 minutes you'll never get back? I think we know.
Wild Mountain Time.
Yeah.
Well, I have at least really enjoyed talking about Wild Mountain Time. I think like that it has given me that gift. God, that's a tough one because I really like Without Remorse and Beast. But I think probably for a bit of escapism, Without Remorse. But I'd really like to see Without Remorse on a big screen. Like, so I'm wondering whether maybe when the cinemas reopen in just a few short weeks, that might be worth doing. Because there's a particular set piece with a plane that like I think on the big screen would just be absolutely amazing.
Yeah. It was pretty good. Okay, so before we finish then, time for a reader's question. Which film have you never seen the end of and why? Layla?
I like horror films, but it's a kind of weird issue that I have because I'm also a wuss. So I haven't made it to the end of a couple of like the really extreme ones. I haven't made it to the end of Martyrs, and I haven't made it to the end of a Serbian film, and I haven't made it to the end of Cannibal Holocaust because they started killing live animals on screen and I was like, no thank you. So yeah those ones.
Good reasoning. What about you, Masana?
Yeah, my reasoning is very different. For me, the film Black Hat, which I really wanted to like because I adore Michael Mann's filmography, but I've tried watching it twice and it can never engage me the way I want it to. I think it's close to 2.5 hours long, so I have not reached the end of it because whether it's at the 90-minute point or 120-minute point, I just get bored. It's just... I keep wanting to revisit it because I'm sure it's brilliant. It's Michael Mann. I love all of his films. Yeah, I think I'm due a revisit, but I still have never seen the end of that film.
Mine are a couple. So Barry Lyndon, I've never got to the end of, which I know is bad. But again, I'm like, I feel like I've got a sense of this and I don't think I want any more of it. Thank you. And the other one is In the Bedroom. There was a film I watched on a plane. And you know that classic thing where you've watched quite a few films and then you get to one and you're watching it. They turn the service off because we're about to land. And you're like, but I was about... And unfortunately, that film has never compelled me enough to actually find it to watch the last 10 minutes. So I still have no idea what happens at the end of In the Bedroom.
I've seen it, but I can't remember. So it can't have been anything great.
Yeah, I assume there wasn't a twist.
The first act of that film is the most memorable. I'm sure you remember that bit with Marissa Tomei and Nick Stahl. Yeah, I'm not sure about the last act. I know that the director is making a comeback with Cate Blanchett, and I can't wait for that. Maybe you'll finish that film.
Maybe I just need to find it and watch it just to see. It's weird because it's not a film I really think about ever, apart from the fact that I know I've never seen the end of it. So Let us know on Twitter any films you've not seen the end of and why. And also this week, the new issue of Total Film is out to buy. It's out tomorrow. And it's got James Gunn's Suicide Squad on a gatefold cover. And if you don't know what a gatefold cover is, it's one that opens out because there's so many of them. So please do seek it out because there's quite a bit of shark on there. You looking forward to Suicide Squad, you two?
Yeah, really looking forward to it. I love James Gunn. Slither is like one of my all-time favorites. And I just think he has such a cool way with like humor and violence and tonal shifts that Mountain Time doesn't manage. I mean, I was really excited for the first Suicide Squad, which was a big letdown, but I think he might pull this off.
I cannot wait for a very similar reason. To me, it feels like it's undoing the poor work from the first Suicide Squad. It's rebooting the story with the panache that it deserves. It just looks like an absolute blast. I'm so glad that it's coming out after cinemas reopen as well.
Yeah, you want to see that on a big screen. And James Gunn is such a nerd in the best way that you want a nerd doing this film, don't you? Sort of bringing the obscure characters, well, more obscure characters out.
And he's got such a good knack at kind of casting, like, surprising character actors and things. I'm very excited to see Nathan Fillion as Arm Fall Off Boy. Yeah, I was thrilled when I saw the cover.
Yeah, so do have a look for that. It's in shops tomorrow. So for now, I think we will say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us, you two. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.